Golf Today.
Welcome into Golf Today. I'm Eamon Lynch alongside George Savarikas. It's the final stop of the Florida swing on the PGA Tour, the Valspar Championship. Something of a revolving door happening the last couple of days, George. A lot of guys withdrawing, which is not surprising. It's a tough swing for these guys. 6 weeks of a lot of elevated events in the players. Akshay Bhatia, the most recent winner at the Bay Hill tournament, he's out this morning. Is this something we should get used to seeing more often when the tour does ask guys to play more events in a tighter span? Are body issues going to become more of a topic of conversation?
I don't think so, because if you look at the RBC Heritage and the Travelers, there's maybe a withdrawal. You see all the big names right after. I think it's the incentive structure. If you have a signature event that has the full amount of FedEx Cup points in a larger purse, guys are more inclined to push it versus if it's one of the regular events on the PGA Tour, then you may have guys after a 2 week stretch like Akshay just played with Bay Hill and the players who say, all right, I'll take my breather this week and then maybe add one leading into the Masters. And I don't know that guys are asked to play more per se, because if you look at the star players on the PGA Tour, end of the season, they've normally played 19 to 22 PGA Tour events. Maybe they
spend them in a little tighter window, potentially.
But that 19 to 22 events is always January through August.
Not for a lot of them. For a Rory McIlroy or Tommy Fleetwood, they play maybe 15, their minimum, in that window. And the other four or five that they play during the year tend to happen in Europe. So some guys will actually be asked to play a little bit tighter schedules. But I guess it's all going to come out in the wash in the cadence of what this schedule looks like going forward.
Yeah, no, for sure. So it'll be more to come, as they say. Interesting to see what shakes out when Brian Rolapp meets with the media at the Travelers Championship. And the PGA Tour makes its final stop of the Florida swing this week at the Valspar Championship at Innisbrook. First round coverage coming your way live this Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel. Valspar Championship notables who are in the field, and we know Akshay Bhatia just WD'd, so some of the other names to keep an eye on: defending champion Victor Hovland, Xander Schauffele. How about Justin Thomas, who was in the mix until the final three holes a year ago on the Copperhead course, and Jordan Spieth, a past champion in 2015, also one of the players tainted up.
And speaking of Xander Schauffele, he finished strong on Sunday in the final round of the Players. This birdie on the 72nd hole kept a final round 69. That was good enough for a solo third finish at TPC Sawgrass. And he's shown some pretty good form in the past at Innisbrook Resort, the host venue this week. In his last three starts in the Valspar, he's finished no worse than a tie for 12th. And that includes his tie for fifth place back in 2024. Now he's going off in the first round alongside Keegan Bradley and his buddy Patrick Cantlay. They are at 8:24 Eastern time. And for more on this week's event, we say hello to Amy Rogers.
Two players out here this week that have referred to themselves as old guys: Xander Schauffele, who's making his 209th start, and Lucas Glover, who's playing his 23rd season on the PGA Tour, have seen and heard a lot during their time out here competing. Last week, CEO Brian Rolapp shared his future vision for the tour, along with six key areas of focus. Well, yesterday, while Schauffele was meeting with the media here, he was asked about his impressions of Rolapp's comments. He not only shared his feedback, but Schauffele also described how he's learned how complex it can be to bring about change out here on the PGA Tour.
Like I said, this is my 209th event. As I get older, I'm starting to realize there's a lot more that goes into a tournament than I thought, you know, 200 events ago. I'm starting to realize that there's a lot that goes into it. And when you want to change things and make everyone happy and sort of create a structure that's supposed to be there for 50 plus years, I wouldn't want to have that job. So, he's asked us to be patient, and, you know, I think we're appreciative that he's communicating well and kind of keeping things in front of us. Other than that, no, I mean, I'm not going to sit and speculate. Did that for too many years. So just being patient, trusting that he's going to do the right thing by all the players and set the tour up for a good future.
Now, Glover has been highly critical of some of the recent changes that have been brought about on the PGA Tour in recent years. And after 10 years of being asked to join the Player Advisory Council, Glover finally agreed to, feeling like he could bring about more change being on the inside rather than clamoring for change on the outside. He's now chairman of the PAC. And I asked him earlier today not just about what he'd like to see change in the coming weeks and months on the PGA Tour, but to also get his feedback on the comments he heard from Rolap last week.
I hadn't had a ton of time to read over it, but just general outline. Looks like headed in a direction for bigger fields and a smaller, compact season. So, you know, I think we're doing what our partners and in TV and media are suggesting and trying to anyway. So, you know, if that's what's deemed best for the tour and hopefully what's best for golf, then that's probably the best thing.
What areas would you particularly like to impart sort of your wisdom and maybe see some changes going forward?
I still think pace of play is a massive issue. I think the penalties need to be harsher and we need to put our best foot forward in helping players get faster. It's never been a number of players in my eyes. It's a player problem. All of us can be better with our pace. And reality is that's costing us viewers and costing us things because it's become hard to watch. And smaller fields have helped, but at the same time, we're also in twosomes a lot of the time, but you get a Thursday Friday situation with threesomes and 120, 130, 140, doesn't matter. It's going to take a long time because we're slow. We as a group are slow. There's fast players, there's really, really slow players, but we're all really, you know, under one umbrella. We're slow. And, you know, I think speeding it up, similar to what baseball's done, and their trajectory is retaken off with the pitch clock. And I'm not saying we need a shot clock. That's not possible, in my opinion. But there's things we can do to speed up and make it more entertaining for people on the ground and people watching. And that'll help us, too, with all these new situations. It's got to be more entertaining. It's got to be more go, go, go. It's not fun to watch me or anybody else walk around a putt for 2 minutes. It's just not. I think our partners could help us by not showing all that too. But at the same time, we as a group need to speed up.
Glover also told me that he ran into Rolap recently at TGL and they had a conversation about the golf ball rollback. Glover said that while Rolap has acknowledged there are things that he needs to learn and obviously is willing to wait on some things, he said that he thinks that Rolap is a faster learner than maybe he lets on.
Thanks, Amy. So Lucas Glover demanding that Brian Rolap give electric cattle prods to all the marshals out there to get the players going. Is that as big an issue, you think, on the tour as it's, you know, obviously a lot of big issues on the tour these days. Is that as big an issue as Lucas thinks it is in your mind?
I think it's twofold. And from a broadcast partner standpoint and someone who works in live tournaments quite frequently, Lucas, we hide so often.
Yeah.
Guys walking around for a minute and a half, 2 minutes with shot selection.
It's
or
actually
with
worse
putts.
Than you see on TV.
Significantly worse. Normally, the producers behind the scenes do a phenomenal job. They just cut to when a guy's about to step in to a shot. If we just showed that, it would be like watching paint dry for a lot of it throughout the course of a round. I'm going to give you a couple sport examples in which legislative change occurred. Premier League flopping used to be an issue, now a yellow card. Culturally, completely shifted. Guys no longer really take dives or flop anymore. Baseball had a pace of play issue, put in the shot clock, pitch clock, game shortened about 30 to 40 minutes. Now, two sports that have systemic problems that haven't changed, flopping in the NBA. Adam Silver hasn't made any changes there. It should be a flagrant or a technical. Guys like that would stop doing that. Mm-hmm. In golf, slow play impacts fast players. Fast players do not impact slow players. So not only is it a competitive advantage, it is viewer repellent at times if you're watching guys who happen to take forever. I get conditions should be a factor, but there can be legislative change. The PGA Tour doesn't want to enact it. A shot penalty is what it should be because they don't want to they think monetarily is how we should enforce it instead of shots. It's when you look at the hierarchy of changes that should be made, they've been feckless, pretty much, in trying to enforce shot penalties. The last one was, what, 1995 by the PGA Tour? Last one in a major was, what, Guan Tin Long in 2013 at the Masters? It should be a shot penalty, but you need buy-in from PGA Tour membership, and the PGA Tour members know who the slow players are, and they disproportionately impact the fast players. And part of it is, if you have a 156-man field and getting it around takes forever, but it should just be, you have a threesome, one guy is playing his ball, the other two should be going through their pre-shot routine, so by the time it's their turn to hit, they're ready to step into the shot. This is stuff you learn when you play junior golf.
It really is borderline unsportsmanlike conduct to some extent. I want to go back to what Xander Schauffele was saying there about the broader changes that Brian Rolapp is trying to enforce here. He said he hopes he does the right thing by all the players. Is that actually possible in a way? Because once you start to talk about eligibility and playing opportunities, and obviously the field sizes is going to be well received in the locker room, but when you bring in a promotion relegation system, is it possible that Brian Rolapp can actually devise a scheme that is going to get universal support in the locker room in your mind?
I don't think you can get universal support because, I mean, we've been covering the live conversations and then the PGA Tour reaction since 2020, end of 21, spring of 22. Mm-hmm. I can think of maybe once that we've heard a player who spoke contrary to his own interests. The rank and file guys want more playing opportunities. The stars were saying, oh, it needs to be these shrunken down fields. I do think 120 is a good number to land on. Lucas Glover or those type of players who had been very outspoken saying the tour was going in a wrong direction. That is more the ethos of what the tour stands for. And that, I think, is actually a good field size to be able to get the first and second round done before it's dark out, to actually have a cut to make Fridays meaningful, which is what the PGA Tour has embodied for so long. I think that's about as close as you can get with a move like that. What about you?
I think the two issues are very much intertwined. I mean, we had a 120-man field out in Phoenix and didn't finish either the first or the second round. So Lucas Glover does have a point. It all kind of blends in together, but it's very difficult for guys to make the case that the fields ought to be bigger than 120 to keep them somewhere where they've been over recent years in the 150 mark and still actually have a quality product out there. You could argue that it needs to be more cutthroat, it needs to be thinned out, but a lot of these issues are interwoven. Pace of play does actually affect the quality of the product, and it certainly affects the number of guys who can legitimately get starts out there. I do think Rolapp will get support for the idea of reintroducing a cut because you have to be meaningfully judged against the quality of the competition in that week. And you can make some argument, well, I was top 50 on the points list last year, therefore I don't face a cut in eight events this year. I think that's a ridiculous attitude to have. But the 120 field, I think that gets him a lot of goodwill in the locker room. But the promotion relegation between the tiers that he's talking about, the number, the potential number of fully exempt cards, they cut it from 125 to 100. Now we have players out there, Mackenzie Hughes, for instance, in Golf Week yesterday was rumbling that there's a potential for cutting that even further with no conditional status, that it's the top 90 perhaps, and you're either in or you're out. But there's no little caveat that will get you in. Once you start to touch on the eligibility criteria, which is Byzantine by the tour standards, that's where it's going to get really awkward in terms of how the locker room reacts.
Well, modern day golf fans completely forget that the tour was all exempt and it was just the top 60 until the early 80s. And then they switched to 125 and now you've had this the job security in a sense where they doubled the size of players who then carry over to the next season. So I think currently speaking, 100, a good number, especially if the fields are going to 120. That means those 100 can get into the majority of these fields week to week if you have earned your card. Structurally, that hasn't been the case right now where guys are fighting for starts, even if they've got their card for the following season on the PGA Tour.
I'm good if you make it 90. Just bring back the Monday qualifiers and give us a real kind of Hunger Games way to play your way into tour events every week.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Golf Today cruising along this Wednesday. LPGA Tour season started in Orlando. Nelly Korda securing the title in the Hilton Grand Vacations Tournament at Champions. Third round 64 was good enough as the final round was canceled due to those frigid conditions. The tour then began its Asian swing where world number one Gino Titicoon earned a dream victory, taking the title in her home country for her very first time, Honda LPGA Thailand. The win marked the eighth of her LPGA Tour career.
Now, Australia's Hannah Green was victorious in the HSBC Women's World Championship in Singapore, which is often referred to as Asia's major. It was a one-stroke victory over Austin Kim. That was her second career victory in the event, having also won the title back in 2024. And Miyang Li won the most recent event, the Blue Bay LPGA, for her third career title. It's her first victory in more than 8 years. Birdie at the last brought her the trophy that came for the first time since the 2017 Scottish Open. And Grant Boone is on the call this week out in Menlo Park, California. Grant joins us now. Grant, what do we need to know about Sharon Heights Golf and Country Club? It's a new venue on the LPGA Tour this year.
Yeah. Hi, Eamon and Georgia. Not just a new venue, but also really the biggest event that this club has ever had. It opened back in 1962, a Jack Fleming design. It was part of a big movement to build new golf courses out here on the peninsula in Northern California. We're just a few minutes away from the Stanford University Golf Course. Todd Eckenrode came in a couple of years ago, massive redesign. It opened the course up, a lot of trees removed, so the sight lines are a lot different. The rough is thick, and it's got some length to it. So I think this is going to be a really good test.
It's her season opening win at the Tournament of Champions. Expectations for her coming into this week?
Yeah, I think, you know, Nelly is one of those players. Her sister Jessica was this way as well. Really needs very little ramp up time to get back going. If you'll recall, back in 2024, she won in Bradenton, Florida, took 7 weeks off, came back and won the next five in a row or four in a row. And I think something that was instilled in them growing up in an athletic family. It's just you come out, you're ready to go from the jump. And you know, in tennis, if you lose your first match, of course, they're from a tennis family, you're out, you know. And so she said this week, in fact, that you can practice, you can train all you want, but there's something fun about just getting back out there and putting a score next to your name. So I'd be very surprised if Nelly did not come out and play well this week.
Grant, there was another young American player, Austin Kim, made a lot of noise in the recent swing through Asia. She was second and tied third in her last two starts. Is that someone you would look to for a breakout year this season?
Yeah, she makes a lot of noise when she hits the golf ball. She absolutely hammers it. And, you know, we've loved watching Austin the last couple of years. She came out as a rookie and a top five at her very first event in Bradenton and made... kept her card easily last year, put herself in contention at some big events, including the KPMG Women's PGA, in which she had a runner-up finish, and she wound up making the CME Group Tour Championship easily. She just absolutely stripes it. And for her, she's a bit of a perfectionist. You know, it's about forgiving yourself a little bit. She's talked about that. And trusting yourself. She has every tool in the bag to become not just a good player, but a really, really great player, I think. And she's really fun to watch. You know, she's born up in the Northeast, grew up in Florida, went to Vanderbilt. I will be surprised if Austin Kim is not on the U.S. Solheim Cup team this fall.
We had LPGA Tour Commissioner Craig Kesler on Golf Central yesterday, and he's talked about optimizing the schedule. There are currently two different Asian swings, one beginning of the year, one the end of the year. What would you like to see the schedule and how it's structured in the future?
That's the perennial conundrum for the LPGA Tour. I hear a lot of people saying, you know, why are they going here, then back here, then zigzagging? This is not by choice always. You know, the LPGA is trying to, like every tour, bring sponsors and venues together and make it all fit. And though that Asian swing, both Asian swings have been critically important over the last 15 years in many ways to help really buttress the LPGA Tour during some times when things weren't so great. Now things are burgeoning out here. And I think streamlining it is a huge goal for Craig. I am thinking this week, as we honor the 13 founders, that in a way it is fitting that, you know, we've already been Florida, you know, three countries in Asia and now here to California. When they had that very first year back in 1950, they had an event called the Weather Vane, and it was 144 holes spread out over different venues and different dates. Babes Aharias won one at Pebble Beach, and it was just, which is not far away from here. It is kind of the nature of the LPGA. It is kind of a tip of the cap to history. And now you think about the Fortinet Founders Cup. It's now been in Phoenix. It's been in Florida. It's been up in New Jersey. And now out here in California. In a way, it is kind of that homage to these 13 amazing women.
Grant, you mentioned the Solheim Cup, which is happening in the Netherlands in mid-September. Are you expecting much changes on the teams that we've become accustomed to over the last couple of years?
We'll see how it all shakes out, but I'm excited to see the chase for it because every single European player, every single American hopeful has it on their minds. Morgan Pressel talked about, you know, you knew when it was a Solheim Cup year and it just did something to you. And I'm thinking about the European invasion that we've had this year on the LPGA Tour. Remember, we had Japan make such a great splash in the last couple of years, but just from Q School alone, you've got the statuesque German Helen Bream, who won the Q Series. You have Nastasia Nadeau from France. You've got Chiara Tamberlini of Switzerland. Mimi Rhodes from England got through Q School as well. You add them to Lottie Wode and, of course, to Charlie Hull. And I think what you're going to see is this new energy, new influx of European talent. It's really going to make that chase fun. Then you've got the American side with players like Austin Kim trying to make it for the first time. And as you noted, in the Netherlands for the very first time, I think it's going to be a lot of fun, not just when we get there this fall, but that the run up to it is always dramatic. Let's say that.
Well, the run up leading into the season's first major, the Chevron Championship, we go Bay Area, Phoenix, Vegas, L.A., not too shabby. And then we kick it off with major number one. Have a good call this week, Grant.
Okay, gang. See ya.
So I named the cities. Here are the actual events. Fortinet Founders Cup in Menlo Park, California. Ford Championship. Good to see Ford back in the mix. In Phoenix, Arizona. That's the end of March. We turn the calendar to April. Aramco Championship. It's Shadow Creek and then JM Eagle in LA. And of course, the Chevron Championship, April 23rd through 26th in Houston. Let's check in on the Epson Tour Road to the LPGA. Cool story that unfolded over the weekend. Zhongyun Li 6 in a commanding final round performance got the win at the IOA Golf Classic. That's her second pro title. First since the 2019 U.S. Women's Open, the win moves her to the top spot in the race for the card standings.
We're back on golf today. Here's a few notable recent winners of the Valspar Championship. Jordan Spieth, fresh-faced youngster of just 21 back in 2015 when he beat Sean O'Hara and Patrick Reed in a playoff. Another playoff came 2022. Sam Burns successfully defended his title. His lengthy 30-footer for birdie on the second playoff hole to beat Davis Riley, the third win of Burns' career. Got it, a couple more since then.
I mean, we've had some good finishes in the Valspar Championship. How about last year, Victor Hovland went birdie-birdie on 16 and 17 to take the lead over Justin Thomas. He had a two-shot lead going the final hole. A bogey on the last, he wins by one. That was his first win since winning the FedEx Cup in 2023, seventh win of his career. Here's how to watch, Thursday, Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern on Golf Channel. Saturday, Sunday, earlier tip time at 1 o'clock Eastern, then 3 p.m. Eastern on NBC. And we got one of the guys on the call this week in Palm Harbor, Florida, Tom Abbott. And Tom, we see some of the star power that is in the mix this week. You have major champions, past winners of this event. Tee us up for some of the storylines to watch for.
Oh, good to be with you, George, and good to be here at Innisbrook. This golf course is one of the tougher golf courses that they see in the first half of the season on the PGA Tour, certainly during this Florida swing, which is coming to a close this week. And I think really we start to look towards the Masters, don't we? The Players is in the rearview mirror, and now we start to look towards the Masters, and we start to look towards the bigger name players in the field here rounding into form. Take Xander Schauffele, for example, somebody who's in good form, a lot of eyes on him to potentially get the job done. You just talked about what happened last year, the two players in the mix at the very end, Victor Hovland, Justin Thomas, both here this year, both in different positions in their games in terms of Justin Thomas, of course, coming back from that injury and rounding into form. If you look at the way he's played over the last few weeks, you would say he would be one of the favorites to win here. And of course, Victor Hovland, who said 12 months ago that his game wasn't in great shape, comes in this week saying he's not driving the ball very well, and that's something you've got to do here. But certainly he would be a player to watch. So I think the storylines really center around the big name players in the field and how they will compete and round into form as we get into a very important stretch in the calendar.
Tom, Brooks Koepka is also in the field this week. He seems to be rounding into a little bit of form as well, a top 10 at the Cognizant Classic. He was in the top 10 at the Players until he double bogeyed the final hole of the tournament to finish tied for 13th. Would you be surprised if he could actually win this week out there?
No, I certainly wouldn't be surprised, because if you look at the caliber of play that he's had in his career, he is a player who should be winning on the PGA Tour. But even when he was at his best winning major championships, he was really focused on playing in the majors and playing and winning majors. And that was kind of his thing, wasn't it? He wasn't always in the best form in regular PGA Tour events. It was the majors that brought out the best in him. But I think it would be very important for him, Eamon, to get a victory or at least be right in the mix come Sunday, come the last few holes on Sunday, to prove that this decision is the right decision for him to come back to the PGA Tour and to compete with the best players in the world out here. So I think it would be important for him to be in the mix here. And I think it would add a lot of energy to the game of golf if Brooks Koepka can be back competing at the very end of the week on the PGA Tour. I'd love to see it. I think it would be another chapter in the storied history here that's very interesting over the years.
Tom, we talked about this earlier in the week, last year, leaving the Players. Rory McIlroy is coming off a win. He had a couple wins. Scottie Scheffler had already been on a tear. We knew those were the two best players in the world with an eye towards Augusta. You still think that they will find their form when needed at the Masters. Is there a player in the field, and maybe a big-name guy, who needs a prove-it type week to show that form leading up to Augusta?
Well, I think there's a few players. I mean, look at J.J. Spaun, for example, U.S. Open champion last year, really struggling with his game. I was walking a few holes just earlier. He was playing in the Pro-Am, and, you know, he just looked like the weight of the world was kind of on his shoulders, looking at his golf swing on the phone and, you know, from videos that were taken out there during the Pro-Am. So, you know, someone like that would really do with a good week to boost his game coming in to the Masters in a few weeks' time. And I think there are a few players like that. Look at Jordan Spieth. I mean, Jordan Spieth has had some good results, but he's not been right there at the end, winning on the PGA Tour lately. So someone like that, also a player who could use this week, even if they don't win. I think that's important. We always talk about players winning. Who's going to win this week? Who have you got your money on to win? Even if they don't win here, it's just getting the confidence in their game and getting it to click. And we know that it can just be one week that makes that change. You know, a player can be down in the doldrums, they found something in their golf swing, they post a top five finish, and boom, it gives them that little bit of jet fuel to head into the first major. So I think, as you say, there are a few players in the field here who certainly could do with a good week. Not necessarily a win, but a good performance.
On that subject of finding something unexpectedly, Tom, last year, Victor Hovland, he won the tournament. In his post-round interview, he said to Kira K. Dixon that he'd hit some disgusting golf shots out there, was his phrase. He's become a fascinating listen when he talks about his golf swing. What do you make of his constant searching out there? Is there a danger that he's going to disappear down a rabbit hole that he doesn't necessarily come back out of?
Well, I think that's, you know, that's one way to look at it. I mean, there are so many different characters out here on the PGA Tour, aren't there? And he's certainly one of them. And you do find that there are players that really love the golf swing. They love analyzing the golf thing. They love looking at how they can improve, what they need to do. There is a case of paralysis by analysis. We know that. And I think with Victor, yes. I mean, you would say you don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole. There's a lot of talent there, and he can rely on his talent to win tournaments on the PGA Tour. He doesn't need to get too engrossed in his golf swing and his game. But that is his nature, and you don't really want to change that from a player. If a player really believes in that and they believe that they need to keep doing this process, and that still allows them to win, then you don't really want to mess with that too much. But I think there is a case with Victor that, you know, you may be overanalyzing at times and getting a little bit down in his game, but still he's got the talent to do it. And what was important last year was his putting. I mean, that was what won him this championship. He wins championships a lot of time out here on the PGA Tour. But the putting was really key for him, and finding that form with the putter. So even when the golf swing is not exactly where it is, if your putter is hot, you know you're going to be in contention.
Tom, you've also covered the LPGA Tour for a long time, and we had the commissioner Craig Kesler with us on Golf Central yesterday. And there's an interesting contrast between what we see on the PGA Tour. And last year, four guys among the top 10 in driving distance combined for six wins, Rory McIlroy, one of them. And on the LPGA Tour last year, top 10 in driving distance didn't record a single victory. So do you think when we look at growth for the LPGA Tour, distance should be rewarded more comparable to how it is on the PGA Tour?
I mean, I think distance is something that makes fans watch the game. And I think it has made the game more popular in the last decade or so. People like to watch players hit it a long way. It's something that most golfers cannot do. They certainly can't hit it a long way and hit it straight, which a lot of players on the LPGA Tour can do. So I do think distance is an important part of the LPGA story. I think it's very interesting that stat that you talked about, the top players in driving distance are not winning on the LPGA Tour. There may be some different factors involved in that. But I think when you look at the number of winners on the LPGA Tour last year, I don't think that is a sustainable situation for the LPGA. I think you need some stars winning more. That's what we've seen at the beginning of 2026, which has set the LPGA in a good trend for this season. But there are some players who hit it a long way who are really fun to watch. Someone like Julia Lopez Ramirez, the Spanish player early in her LPGA career who hits the ball a mile. And she is really fun to watch. And I think, yes, I think there is a case for the LPGA to look at course setups and the way that the golf courses are presented. It's not necessarily moving in the direction of rewarding the long players all the time. But I think there is a case to look at that, considering what happened last year with all of those winners. And maybe there isn't a case to be heard. Maybe it's, no, we're doing the right thing. This is the way it should be. But I think it's certainly something that to look at on the LPGA Tour, because I do think distance really breeds interest in the game of golf. And we've seen that over the last decade or so.
Interesting time in professional golf. You have a new commissioner on the LPGA Tour with Craig Kesler, a new PGA Tour CEO and Brian Rolapp, same timelines, trying to enact changes on both tours. And Tom, you cover both, and we're looking forward to seeing you on the broadcast this week at the Valspar Championship. Enjoy it.
Thanks, George.